This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Tomorrow's school board elections will shape local education policy for the next several years. The results will have the most impact on a group of people who mostly don't have a say at the ballot box, the students. But as Madeline Fox reports, some Wisconsin students are finding other ways to make their voices heard. We'll come back to that story later, having some difficulty bringing it up. For now, though, gas prices remain high across the United States, but federal and state governments are looking into ways to provide some relief at the pump. Some states, not including Wisconsin, have created gas tax holidays, and President Biden is tapping into the country's strategic reserve of petroleum to make supply more available right away. It's led to questions about what actions would actually have an impact on gas prices and how sustainable those interventions are. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. How are higher gas prices affecting you? How would you like to see the government address the problem, if at all? Do you think it is the federal government's responsibility? Do you want to see states like Wisconsin at least temporarily cut gas taxes? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Menzie Chin is a professor of public affairs and economics at the Robert M. La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Menzie, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me, Rob.
Let's start by putting gas prices in perspective. I know at the nominal level, the actual numbers we see at the gas station, they're at record highs. When we adjust for inflation in real dollars, how do our current gas prices stack up?
Actually, it's a good thing that you mentioned that. I mean, I think there are two factors going on. First of all, we've seen this sort of whiplash in gasoline prices. So, you know, looking back in April 2020, they were $1.84 per gallon on average nationwide, and now we're at $4.22. So you could be excused for thinking, wow, that's both a big increase over a short period of time, relatively speaking. But then, because we haven't remembered the fact that prices in general are rising, you might be surprised to find out that actually the price we're seeing right now is about, on average, the price we've seen over the last 30 years after adjusting for inflation. So that's exactly right. In terms of the inflation-adjusted price, we're pretty close to where we've been in over the past 30 years.
That said, COVID has had some impact on prices. It seems like the big low you mentioned, I believe, is because people weren't going anywhere, and that lowered demand for gas, a lot of industry shutting down for the short term. What has driven that wild swing from the lows to the highs now?
Well, exactly what you mentioned was that COVID shut down big swaths of the economy, both in terms of work and in terms of leisure and driving around for leisure. So it's not surprising that prices dropped so low during the height of the pandemic. Since then, as you've seen, inflation generally has risen overall as demand for goods and demand for services have picked up with the recovery. So, we saw gasoline prices rising even before this latest round, and we shouldn't have been surprised in some respects that along with the price of everything else, gasoline prices should rise as we have this recovery. Now, on top of that, we have the supply interruption. So before, it was demand rising back to where it was, or closer to where it was before. Now we have the interruption coming from first geopolitical jitters arising from the threat of an invasion and Russia being sanctioned and having the supplies of oil coming from Russia being taken off the world markets. But now we have it, the reality of actually removal of Russian oil supplies from the general global pool of oil. And so it's that's the case where we've seen oil prices jump from, about $90 per barrel back in the beginning of February to $108 today. So as oil prices go, so too go gasoline prices.
In response to those prices, President Biden announced he'll be releasing 1 million barrels of oil a day from the country's strategic reserves. Here's some of what he had to say about the decision last week.
This is a wartime bridge to increase oil supply until production ramps up later this year. And it is by far the largest release of our national reserve in our history. It will provide a historic amount of supply for a historic amount of time, a six-month bridge to the fall. And we'll use the revenue from selling the oil now to to restock the Strategic Petroleum Reserve when prices are lower.
So when this oil starts flowing, Menzie, are we going to see a difference when we roll up to the gas station?
Well, you know, at various times, we've encountered high prices in oil and of course, gasoline then is a political touchstone. And we've often looked for ways in which policymakers can reduce the price of gasoline when it's spiked. The Strategic Petroleum Reserve being tapped is one way in which the president has some influence over oil prices and hence gasoline prices, but it's not a big one. And there are two ways to look at it. First, the oil is in the ground and we have sort of semi-ready access to it. And so if you think about the big pool of oil that's out there that people can tap into, companies and so forth, refiners, well, it's kind of known that it's there and available. So in some ways, you don't expect it to have a big impact on prices when it's actually released into the general pool to be used. But another way of putting it in context is to think, well, each day, the president's proposing to release about 1 million barrels per day for a total of 180 million barrels, which is enormous, actually, relative to the fact that we've got about 565 million barrels in the reserve. So it's a big chunk of our reserve being released. And that's on top of the 50 million we released starting back in November. But, you know, what are we responding to? And in part, over the past 2 months, we've been responding to the possibility and then the actuality of sanctions on Russian oil exports. And so, well, what's relevant then is how much oil does Russia export? And it's something on the order of 5 million barrels per day of just crude oil, and perhaps another 4 to 5 million of sort of petroleum derivatives and so forth. So, you know, you've got this big withdrawal of oil in principle from the supply in world markets, and you're only making up a portion of it. And so on the day that the announcement was made, you know, oil prices dropped about a dollar from the beginning, the opening of the trading to the close. And that reflects the fact that it's hard to have a big influence on a global market for oil just by turning on the taps on the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And that's not to say it's not a good idea. I mean, there are very few things that you can do, and that's one of them. And so what you're doing is you're trying to moderate prices a little bit and signal your willingness to try to do other things as well. So in some sense, I would say, you know, why not try something? This is a big change in oil and hence gasoline prices that you want to mitigate for the population.
Talking to economist Menzie Chin from UW-Madison about the price of oil and gas. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. David is with us in Eau Claire. David, hi.
Yeah, hi. I've got two comments and I think one question. My comments are, one, I think as Wisconsinites, we should be very happy to pay more gas. Well, here's my comments for two reasons. One, for environmental reasons. We are at a tipping point environmentally, and globally, we should all, as citizens, try and stop the burning of the fuels as much as we can. And the second reason we as Wisconsinites should be very happy to pay for more gas is to, in part, push for peace and disarmament in the world, in so much as that we're funding wars by our purchasing of oil and gas from various authoritarian regimes as well as oligarchs in our own country. My question is, do you think that the current conflict in Ukraine will add a real push to the environmental impetus or in need that we really need to get off of these fossil fuels?
Got it. David, thanks for the call. Menzie, is this situation higher prices and, as David says, the Russian invasion of Ukraine adding impetus to getting away from these petroleum products in the first place?
Well, I think we've got lots of understanding that we do want to move away from a carbon-based economy in terms of fuels and so forth. And I guess to a certain extent, having this volatility in energy prices only highlights the dangers of relying upon energy, especially as that has to be produced and then shipped far distances to here to be consumed. So I'm hopeful. I'm not sure, because we have seen spikes in energy prices before, as in 2008. You know, the price of oil was in real terms much higher in 2008 than it is right now. And yet, you know, we still saw resistance and still see resistance to moving towards, for instance, a carbon tax or some other way of imputing a higher price for use of fossil fuels. So I'm hopeful. I hope that happens. I'm not sure it will in great part.
David, thanks for the call. We're talking to UW-Madison Public Affairs and Economics Professor Menzi Chin about gas prices and how to bring them down, if that's possible. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Would you want to see a Wisconsin gas tax holiday? How about a federal gas tax holiday? Would you rather get government rebates or direct payments? How much are high gas prices affecting you right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Menzi Chin, professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison. With us today, looking at gas and oil markets, why prices have gone up over the last couple of years. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see quick short-term action from state or federal government cutting gas taxes? What do you think of the idea of releasing petroleum from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve? Do you want to see the U.S. be less dependent on petroleum products? If so, how? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Dubuque. Jim, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering what your guest thinks about whether we may have moved global de-dollarization into warp speed by finding ourselves now with oil being traded in other currencies and people, other countries are afraid to leave their foreign exchange reserves in our control.
Jim, thanks for that call. Interesting question, Menzi. I've seen Russia demanding rubles in some cases for oil and natural gas payments. Negotiations between Saudi Arabia, I believe, and China saying, hey, maybe we can sell and buy oil with something other than dollars. How big a deal is that?
So that's an interesting question. I should mention that the demise of the dollar as the international currency has been forecasted like 20 times out of the last 40 years. What's true is that the reliance on the dollar makes various countries vulnerable, and in particular, commodity exporters are even more vulnerable to the extent that almost all commodities are priced in dollars, and so typically you're going to see invoicing in dollars, and that's dollars are what they're going to be accumulating. And so the use of sanctions in this case, and this is not the only case, Iran beforehand, has definitely made it in the interest of various entities, governments that think they might fall on the wrong side of U.S. interests, has given them a impetus to try to diversify and get away from both use of the dollar, but also financial infrastructure like the SWIFT and so forth, the international messaging system that banks use, that aren't under the control of the U.S. I guess the answer is yes. You've given a motivation for countries to diversify, but it's going to be costly, and so they're seeing the costs right now of being reliant upon the dollar. Maybe that'll move them towards, you know, trying to move away from use of the dollar. That's in fact what Russia tried to do, and we now see. In some ways, how ineffective it was. Yes, they diversified out of dollars in terms of the reserves, but a lot of their reserves are in other or with other central banks and other banks, which are now afraid of undertaking transactions because the U.S. would then sanction them for dealing with Russia. So, you know, it's not just the use of the dollar, but it's also the international infrastructure that's linked in by way of messaging systems, but by way of transacting with American banks and financial institutions. Diversifying away is very, very costly. And then you have to ask yourself, when the war is over and you go back to something that's more like normal times, these countries, are they going to be willing to pay the price to operate their own systems, develop their own systems, and to somehow have more reserves in, let's say, euros. I don't think they're going to diversify a lot into renminbi, the Chinese currency, because that will be very costly to use and transact. In the end, I'd say, yes, there's a potential for dethroning the dollar, but I don't see it as defining a big shift away from the dollar as the dominant currency in international transactions.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Janice in Lac du Flambeau. Janice, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I have driven a Prius for maybe 15, 20 years now. And I drive it because it's a hybrid and it cuts down on emissions, et cetera, et cetera. However, in the last 2 years when I have renewed my license plate, instead of the normal $85 that everybody in Wisconsin is charged, I'm charged $160. And so are everybody else who I know who drives an energy-efficient hybrid or all-electric car. And I talked to our lieutenant governor about this 2 years ago or so, and he said, well, it was because we weren't paying our fair share of gas taxes. In my opinion, the gas guzzler should be paying, raise the rate for everybody and let the gas guzzlers get rid of their gas guzzling cars and pay fewer gas tax.
Janice, thanks a lot for your call. Menzie, Janice getting into some of the finer points of government taxes and motivation when it comes to fuel savings. The rationale, as Janice was saying, for that higher fee was you're buying less gas, paying less tax to maintain the roads. Are we trying to sort out this policy on what we want to motivate consumers to do here?
So I think that's an excellent point and excellent question. I mean, you got to think about, you know, there's these proposals to give a tax holiday on gasoline. And so that seems like a good idea. But you have to realize that the gas tax does what? It provides about 60% of the funds in the federal highway funding for roads and so forth. That's at the federal level. There's probably more at the state level as well. And so, you know, those taxes are being used for something. If you provide a tax holiday, they're going to disappear. And at the same time, I think federal taxes are about 48 cents on each gallon. So it's not a particularly big chunk of the cost of gasoline. You're not going to have a tremendous impact given how high prices are now. So tax holiday doesn't make sense. From that standpoint, both standpoints, funding and in terms of impact. On the other hand, this issue about whether a hybrid should pay, I mean, that goes to the issue about who should be supporting the highway, the funding for maintaining highways and roads. And the fact of the matter is, a Prius, while it doesn't contribute as much carbon to the atmosphere, at the same time, it does impose wear on the roads. And so, you know, as you are moving away from gasoline as a power mode for vehicles, you know, you're running down the amount of funds that are available to be devoted to keeping the roads up, which everybody, both hybrids, electrics, and conventional vehicles, are using. While I think it sounds a little perverse, we should be encouraging the use of hybrids and electrics. You know, we do need to fund roads and highways. And so the question then is, how can we reformulate our tax system in order to do that in an efficient and equitable fashion?
Thanks for the call, Janice. We'll go to Bill now in Watertown. Bill, hi.
Yes, hello. Rebating a gas tax, you just talked about some of the drawbacks to it. Others are that if there's any excess profits going on right now in the oil and gas industry, and it's human nature that might be the case, wouldn't get rid of that. And so I'm thinking that we should be looking into excess profit taxes right now, wartime excess profit taxes, and then taking and rebating, putting a cap on that and rebating the excess back to those less able to pay. This gasoline, high gasoline prices right now are a bit of a regressive tax for very poor people who can least afford it.
Bill, thanks for the call. Menzie, what do you think of that idea? Presumably somebody's making more money with oil and gas prices being higher. What do you think of the idea of, tax on that to help people who can't afford that gas right now?
Well, in principle, I'm sympathetic to it. The question is, I'm sure profits will rise somewhat. But it's true that, you know, for a gallon of gasoline, about 61% of it is accounted for just by oil. And so we have a rule of thumb in the business that for each dollar increase in the price of oil, you get, you know, about 2.5 cents increase in the price of gasoline. So, you know, if there's a big deviation from that and you get big increases in profits for oil companies, yes, I can see why you might want to redistribute the profits back to people. And that's probably better than some of the other alternative ways of trying to lessen the impact on households. I guess the question I'd ask is, you know, if you do rebate the profits, you know, in a way, you're giving that to people who would then presumably spend a big share of that still on gasoline. And that would just keep up the demand for gasoline. And part of the sort of market forces that we want to appeal to, especially if you're thinking about environmental concerns, is that higher prices will induce people to conserve on the use of gasoline. So, yes, in terms of sort of mitigating the harm that might hit households who happen to be using cars as their gasoline-driven cars as their main means of transport. But it's probably not going to be completely equitable. And I'm in some ways, it works at cross purposes with some of the things that you might want to do, including encouraging conservation.
Bill, thanks for the call. And Menzie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Menzie Chin is professor of public affairs and economics at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. With us today, looking at gas prices in the U.S. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, check out transportation projects around the state and share your local priorities. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our car headlights getting too bright. Sometimes, yes, and there's been a recall of some of them. Find out more about the blinding lights. First, opioid addiction, gun violence, and COVID-19 are some of the most tragic and costly public health problems facing people in Wisconsin and around the country. Our next guest has worked on the front lines of all three problems as an emergency physician in Milwaukee, and she's been working on steps to prevent those emergencies in the first place. For her work, Dr. Juliana Denier has been recognized as one of USA Today's Women of the Year. Dr. Julie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me today. This is quite an honor.
Before we get into some of the specific programs you've worked on, it seems like part of your approach is to say, yes, I'm an emergency room physician, but I also want to pay attention to the public health issues that are bringing people in the emergency room in the first place. What led you down that path?
I've been lucky enough to be an emergency physician for the last 26 years and have learned that when I meet people in the ER, every single patient I see in the ER pretty much is, there's a lot more happening than what has happened in the 5 minutes prior to them to come to the emergency department. So much of what shapes our patients is specifically what they've gone through in all their lives prior to coming in the doors. If somebody comes in with a stroke, a lot of that has to do with the fact that they haven't gotten their blood pressure medications filled for the last 10 years, or the fact that they've not had access to healthy foods. That's all built into why they walk through our doors in the emergency department. So it really, as emergency providers, it really is life-giving to us to be able to do things to help people not come to our emergency department.
One big reason, of course, that people end up in emergency rooms can relate to opioid overdoses these days. You've got a couple things going on there. Can you talk about what kind of outreach you've been doing for patients who come in with those overdose symptoms?
I would love to talk about it. We are looking at this as kind of a four-pronged approach to helping people with opiate use disorder. First and foremost is just decreasing stigma and talking about opiate use disorder. This is a real problem and one that is treatable. And making sure that people know this is not a moral failing. This is something that we can help with. The second thing we're really trying to do in the emergency department is decrease the number of opiate prescriptions that we're writing for, just to decrease the amount of opiates that are on, that are available to people to buy or use off prescription, off that they haven't been prescribed. Thirdly is harm reduction. If somebody is currently using opiates and they're not at a point where they can stop, we have a program where we give out naloxone. Naloxone is an antidote to opiates. How opiates work in the body is they work as a respiratory depressant. If you take too much of them or accidentally take a different kind of opiate than you think you're going to take, it decreases somebody's ability to breathe. And that's where the problem comes in. People stop breathing and then their heart stops. So naloxone, or you might have heard it as a term, Narcan, mm-hmm. is a medication that can be administered by somebody outside of the hospital to counteract that opiate and bring somebody back to life. It's a really magical medication. And we are giving that out, this Narcan medication to people in the ER. And we are also working on a plan to have people who come into the ER with any problems with opiates or addiction problems to have recovery coaches come and evaluate the patient. So what that is simply is, let's say somebody comes in with an overdose and we evaluate them, maybe give them naloxone, wake them up, and we can call on a recovery coach who is somebody who has had lived experience with opiate use disorder and has had training in to become a recovery coach. They respond to our emergency department and talk to the person where they are. Say, okay, what got you here? Let's talk about this. Are you ready to talk about recovery? And if you are, help them navigate that can be very confusing way to get help. And one of those ways to get help is to be started on medication. We can start that medication in the emergency department. One that we start often in our ER is buprenorphine, and it helps people with the craving for opiates, and it also helps them with the withdrawal symptoms. So those are some of the things we've been doing to really help people when they come in at their most vulnerable in the ER, to help them on the road to recovery if they want to start down that road at that time.
And also, you've been looking at public health approaches to gun violence. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing?
With gun violence, we are giving out gun locks in the emergency department, and that can be anybody who comes up to the desk and say, "Hey," and this is at St. Joseph's Hospital, which is that hospital is in the north side of Milwaukee, and for many, many reasons, that's a part of Wisconsin that is most heavily affected by gun violence. Disproportionately that community is affected by gun violence. So we're really trying to get home safe. So anybody can walk up the desk and say, "Hey, I would like a gun lock," and they will be given a gun lock. They can come go home and put it on a gun if they've got one in their home, to make their home safer. So that's what we're doing for gun violence.
Dr. Denier, I got to say, so you're an emergency physician. I get exhausted just thinking about doing your job. You've come out of COVID. You're doing all these kind of extra things above and beyond, and I still hear the energy and passion in your voice. How? How do you do that?
Oh, well, I work with a wonderful, wonderful group of people. From my group, emergency medicine specialists, who are about the greatest group of physicians and advanced practitioners that I could ever hope to work for. We all work this hard. So this is why it's very embarrassing that I get this honor, because we are all doing our bit. Also, I work with the best nurses in the world, the best phlebotomists. Our team is exceptional. And through COVID, which has been so tough for everyone in the whole world, we have been a family to help each other through it, and to see what people are excited about and help and support them to see what they're excited about. My group, when I became interested in opiates, were like, "Hey, you're our opiate person. We will support you in this." And they gave me all the support in the world to get more involved in this. So it's really my awesome group and everybody that I work with.
Dr. Julie, before we let you go, can you leave us with a bit of inspiration? If someone else is in a situation like you were, where they see a problem and want to tackle it at its root, how do you recommend they get started?
Oh my gosh. And I, in the words of my mother, just do it. I am not a smart person. I am just an ER doc. And I think if you get excited about something and try to do it, I have no knowledge about grant writing, all that kind of stuff, but I got excited about it and people will follow. So just do it. And people will get excited along with you.
Thank you, Dr. Julie, and congratulations on the recognition.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Have a great day.
You too. That's Dr. Juliana Denier, physician with emergency medicine specialist. She joined us today to talk about her work fighting opioid addiction, gun violence, and COVID-19 in her work as a Milwaukee-based physician that recently got her recognized as one of USA Today's Women of the Year. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a new anthem for Wisconsin sports fans.
When the Milwaukee Bucks won their first NBA title in 50 years last year, Milwaukee hip-hop artist Romy was courtside. As a lifelong Bucks fan, the moment was not just a thrill, but inspiring. He recently talked with WPR's Jenny Peek about how that experience led to his hit song, Fear the Deer.
Growing up, Jerome Hunt got to see his dad compete against countless Milwaukee Bucks players. Hunt would watch the one-on-one basketball games go down at Milwaukee's Martin Luther King Jr. Community Center, where his dad was the recreation director.
They had the semi-pro league called the NBA Pro-Am. And so there, that was my first experience at getting around professional athletes, Bucks players, that were looking to get a good run. And I just got to be up close and personal, got to be the water boy. And that was when I pretty much fell in love with it.
He remembers the 1988 grand opening ribbon-cutting ceremony at the Bradley Center and when the Bucks selected Glenn Big Dog Robinson as the 1994 number one overall draft pick.
With the first pick in the 1994 NBA draft, the Milwaukee Bucks select Glenn Robinson from Purdue University.
Time and time again, Hunt fell in love with the Bucks.
The same sort of thing kind of happened when they drafted Giannis, and it was another, like, huge resurgence.
A resurgence that led the team to their first NBA title since 1971.
It's over. The Bucks have done it. The long wait has ended. After a half century, the Milwaukee Bucks are NBA champions once again.
A victory that Hunt, who goes by the stage name Romy, is still basking in.
It meant everything, every kind of valiant peak of the team. You know, I felt like the sixth man. I was just right there, just being inspired by the team.
Bringing home the championship sent a spark of creativity through Romy, a veteran Milwaukee hip-hop artist. Standing courtside after the win, the lyrics to his hit song, Fear the Deer, unraveled before his eyes.
Do it for the city, yep. Do it for the haters. Uh-huh. Do it like Kareem before he went to be a Laker. Yes. 50 years later.
I just went into grind mode, just full, like, I need to capture this. This inspiration and this type of me coming to all these Bucks games since I was a kid and all this culminating into this moment, I had to capture that. And Fear the Deer is that.
Some of Romy's favorite lyrics in the song look to the future instead of just reflecting on last year's glory.
I like the repeat is our move. Greek Freak is that dude.
And like you said in that interview, we can't play with our food. We gon' ride and die for our team, whether we win or whether we lose. I be in the front row, lit like Bakhtiari chugging them brews, man.
I like that because repeat is our mood. And so I wanted to put it in there just to kind of just put it on people's mentals that we have some more winning to do.
Fear the deer, fear the deer, in the deer district, and we chugging beer.
And he's feeling pretty good about the Bucks' chances this season.
We go as far as Giannis, K-Mid, and Drew takes us. And just getting Splash Mountain finally back. Just seeing Brooke Lopez out there to finish the season up to really get back in shape just in time for the playoffs. That was a much-needed addition. We're the champs until somebody beats us. And so that's going to be the mood. That's going to be the mentality.
and Romy will have the chance to deliver that energy on the court at halftime during the Bucks' final home game of the season on April 7th.
When you love music as much as I do, that joy and that passion and that love, when it's reciprocated from the fans and from the listeners, that never gets old. Would you rip that rock? Started up the fast
break. Break. 120 on the clock. WPR's Jenny Peek brought us that story on Milwaukee artist Romy and his new song, Fear the Deer. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum, Bucks in Six.
Coming up, fear the glare. The headlights in our cars have been getting brighter, but they could be getting smarter, too. We'll find out how better headlight design could help prevent accidental collisions and deaths. That's next year on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Do you ever feel like the headlights on some cars are too bright, even dangerously bright? GM recently recalled headlights from certain years of its GMC Terrain SUV. Turns out the problem wasn't the brightness exactly, but a glitch that would cause the light to point in the wrongish direction. But are those GM headlights and other modern car lights actually too bright? Is anything being done about that? These are questions that intrigued Henry Grabar, staff writer at Slate, and inspired a recent piece he wrote there. Henry, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, when you first saw the news about this big GM headlight recall, what was your first response?
Oh, I felt vindicated because I have been writing and complaining about the bright headlight crisis for years now. When I drive sometimes and I drive at night, I'll sometimes adjust my rearview mirror so that I don't have the lights of the person directly behind me shining right in the mirror, because I feel like it makes it hard for me to see in front of the car. And so I have long had a suspicion that headlights are in fact getting brighter. And when I heard about this recall, I thought, oh, they're finally going to deal with the problem.
But not exactly, it sounds like.
No, unfortunately not. The issue with these GMC Terrain headlights is apparently that they, because of the way the reflectors work inside the casing, they shine up and out at a 45-degree angle up. So they might blind like a bird in a nest on the side of the road up in a tree. But they are not responsible for me or for any of your listeners feeling like headlights are particularly bright on the road at night.
Now, I'll admit, Henry, I thought it was just me. Like, maybe this is part of the aging process or something. I don't know. Have headlights changed in some ways that's making them either actually brighter or feel brighter?
Yes. As it turns out, there is a reason that you might feel that there is a lighthouse behind you on the road at night, or in front of you, for that matter, if you're on a two-lane road. And there's a couple things going on. So I talked to some people who study headlights, and I heard three things. I mean, the first of them, which is probably the most important, is that cars are getting bigger and they're getting higher. And so the more SUVs and pickups are on the road, the higher the headlights. And they're supposed to point down. But the other thing that happens is that over time, headlights get bumped out of place. And many state inspections don't even address the question of where the headlight is pointing. So you combine the higher cars and the headlights out of position, and you're liable to get headlights that point right into your eyes on the road at night. So those are two of the problems going on.
Now, but is the intensity of the light getting more, whatever it is?
Well, that's the third thing, right, is that the quality of the light has changed. There used to be halogen lights, then there were high-intensity discharge lights, and now there's LED lights. And LED lights really are brighter, there's a reason that they've become so popular. If you buy a new car today, you're probably going to end up with LED headlights. One of the reasons they're popular is because they're brighter. And so drivers who drive with them feel like they're getting better visibility of the things around them. And they are. And they feel safer. What is happening to the people who are outside their car has not really been the concern of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
Let's bring on a caller. Zeke is with us in Bowler. Zeke, hi.
Hello. I'm only 39. I have no vision problems, but it's impossible to drive at night with these bright lights when roads are wet. I've had
three close calls, and one which took the left mirror off my truck.
Wow.
Because I can't see where I'm driving.
And is this oncoming bright lights from the other direction of traffic, Zeke, or lights behind you in your rearview mirror?
Oncoming traffic.
Okay.
Two-lane roads are bad. Four-lane roads aren't much better. But the people don't even know how to turn the brights off. You flash them, and they just totally ignore you.
Zeke, thanks for the call. Now, Zeke's worried those brights might be on. Could it even be those normal headlights as they're made nowadays that could be blinding us, Henry?
I mean, I would never assume that people, I think lots of people do sometimes leave their brights on because they're just not paying attention to what's going on, right? But I do think that the other thing that might be happening is you may be looking at headlights that have been bumped out of place. You know, most cars on the road, they get their bumps and scratches, and after a while, the lights may get out of position. And one of the guys I talked to did a study of this, and he went around a mall parking lot at night and staring. I guess I don't know if he's blind now or what, but he stared into all these cars' headlights. Wow. And tried to measure how many headlights were out of position and how many were pointing up when they should have been pointing down. And he found that 2/3 of cars have at least one headlight that's somewhat out of position. So that's sort of endemic. And like I said, a lot of state inspections don't even deal with that problem.
Now, thanks for that call, Zeke. You wrote, Henry, that Europe is working on using these adaptive driving beams. We might see them here in the U.S. What are those?
Yeah. So this is cool. LEDs, I think, have brought some of us the pain of staring at these like super cool, really blue lights. But the other thing that they're going to produce is this technology that they have in Europe and in Japan. It's called adaptive driving beam headlights. And as part of the bipartisan infrastructure bill, the Congress is requiring NHTSA to approve these headlights by 2023. So we're going to see these on American roads in the next couple of years. And what they do is they actually sense the arrival of an oncoming driver and redirect the light away from the oncoming car. So it'll sort of be like you have your brights on the whole time with respect to the things that you can see, the road ahead, the landscape around you. But they're actually designed to make sure that the people who are driving in the opposite direction don't get your headlights right in their eyes.
Do we know, Henry, if there are statistics about safety issues with these two bright lights? Do we know that they're implicated in crashes?
You know, I haven't seen any statistics about this. We know that the roads are getting more dangerous, right? That there were more fatal, certainly pedestrian fatalities are at a, I think, an all-time high and are up 50% in the last decade or so. And during the pandemic, obviously, there was a lot of crazy driving and fatalities increased even as the total amount of driving we were doing went down. But I have not heard headlights cited as one of the reasons that that's happening. I think it's for most of us, it's primarily an annoyance, although I can't say for sure.
And just in our last few moments, Henry, you mentioned, you know, those bright lights. If I'm driving the car with the bright lights, that makes me safer. Forget about the rest of you. You've complained about that. Other safety experts have complained about this in the past, not looking at the safety of the people outside this particular vehicle.
Yeah. And unfortunately, that's a point where even the adaptive driving beam headlights, right, they're not going to shine any less brightly for a pedestrian on the side of the road. So if you're somebody who's feeling the glare of the bright headlights because you're walking around or you're riding a bike, those headlights are going to shine on you even brighter than before because they are trying to help the driver see you. And when I talked to somebody about this, I said, well, that sounds like a very painful experience for those of us who have to walk around some of these F-150s. And he said, well, better blind than dead.
Henry, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's Henry Grabar, staff writer at Slate. We talked to them today about car headlights and why they seem to be getting brighter. You can read more from Henry at Slate.com. Share your thoughts with us on bright headlights. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, amid some worrisome economic news, a Wisconsin economist makes the case that the U.S. has a strong and prosperous economy going on right now. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.